We don't need to, we don't have to, it's not, we're not going to listen to the wood. We're not going to listen to the concrete. We're not going to listen. We're going to really just look at and be, the term scientific was brought up a lot with these sorts of designers in the school. We're going to look at things scientifically. We're going to look at things categorically. And we're going to say, okay, what does a house need, right? Particularly, Le Corbusier was designing homes, quite, ironically, somewhat very expensive modern homes in 1920s, 1930s France. But he said this about this tension. He said, our engineers are healthy and virile, active and useful, balanced and happy in their work. Our architects, and by architects, he's talking about people who are more concerned with the aesthetic appeal of a home or of any kind of building, sorry, I should say. Our architects are delusioned and unemployed, boastful or peevish. This is because there will soon be nothing more for them to do. We no longer have the money to erect historical souvenirs. At the same time, everyone needs to wash. Our engineers provide these things, and so they will be our builders. So when he says everyone needs to wash, basically he means that like there's basic necessities to life that everyone needs to do. And if we let the functionality drive it and stop listening to, aesthetics of beauty and concerns about material and how they speak to us and whatever they might be, as Dewey and Bottom are kind of trying to explain, that we can kind of wipe this away. There's more important stuff to be concerned with, effectively. This is, I think, I say this is a bit of a lie, because ultimately, let me give you another quote for you and our listeners as well. This is from a later architect in, philosophy of architecture, by Ruskin. He simply says, John Ruskin proposed, buildings we want two things. We want them to shelter us, which is the functional aspect, but we also want them to speak to us, of whatever we find important and need to be reminded of. And this is the truth of what buildings, I think, actually do. And here's the thing. The modernist architects, who were so seemingly antagonistic to perspectives such as Dewey's or whatever it might be, again, ostensibly letting this sort of utilitarian function of a building determine its content, really only did that insofar as it reflected a form of life that they most valued and thought was important, i.e. one that was modern, open, democratic, thoughtful, irreligious, technological, and in technological is the most important one. These are spaces for technology. And so then we see that, in fact, the aesthetic of these buildings is not non-existent, but is in fact just as reflective of these sorts of new tenets of forms of life as they would have been in, say, a medieval church or home that is reflective of a religious perspective and worldview and form of life. That, in fact, this sort of tension that we're talking about here was more of a diversion, but in fact is still operating in the exact same sort of way that people think of. And so, we can't show our listeners, because this is a radio show, what these sorts of buildings look like, these modernist homes. But frankly, they look a lot like these, by Le Corbusier, look a lot like the modernist homes that many of you are probably familiar with that you'll see perhaps in your own city. A lot of you walk around a lot of neighborhoods in Canada and you'll find houses that are kind of generic. And then there'll be one that's all white, boxy, either all concrete or glass or whatever it might be. These are very similar to the homes he was designing in the 20s and 30s. They aren't like nobody's going to look at them and be like, oh, nobody put any thought into what the way this building looks, right? This is clearly, no one's going to look at this, but this is clearly utilitarian design. If we were going for a fully utilitarian design, then why build this expensive, pristine, imposing structure, and instead not build something completely out of particle board that's just like insulated and it's like whatever, right? Like, it's just like a shelter, And this is reflective of the fact that, like, these, and this is coming back to, again, as both the bottom and Ruskin say, that, you know, buildings speak to us. And that comes back to that form of life, that we are in conversation with the places that we pervade through. And this comes into, again, how they speak to us in terms of Dewey, with, like, the, you know, specific materials and all that are reflected in effectively how we engage with the world, but also how the world engages with us, right? And as, you know, De Bottom kind of puts forward, and we can talk more about this, that effectively, you know, good buildings are good because they elicit certain kinds of virtues that we see reflected in human life already, right? We can describe buildings as thoughtful, as detailed. We can describe buildings as open, caring, democratic. We can describe them as imposing, right? These are all descriptors that you would give to, you know, good aspects of architecture, individualistic, you know, whatever it might be, modern, technological. And the fact is that we give those descriptors because certain buildings effectively elicit those sorts of feelings in us when we look at them, but then they also effectively sort of pave the ground or create a space for us to live in and operate more easily in that particular kind of way.
Yeah, that's one of the things that Dewey also mentions, is that it's also, aside from literature, architecture is one of the most reflexive forms, because if an experience is the product of an organism working its way through an environment, architecture literally constructs environments. When you construct a building and it exemplifies particular virtues, it makes being that virtue conducive. It makes it easier to be that virtue. It also trains certain people if they have a certain architectural or aesthetic sensibility, and if they have the humility to hold up a building as a moral exemplar. But I think most architects do. They really do look to these buildings and praise them for their virtues. And most thoughtful people will look at a building and be refreshed by it in that way.
Buildings speak. They speak on topics which can be readily discerned. They speak on democracy, aristocracy. Oh my, I can't pronounce that word. Why can't I? Aristocracy, openness, arrogance, welcomeness or threatening, sympathy for the future or hankering for the past. There was this, I think, this notion sometimes with aesthetics when we're talking about beauty, right? And this is why our architecture always, why earlier on, you know, I forgot to mention earlier, you know, before the advent of sort of modernist architecture kind of taking over the scene for a little bit in the kind of early to mid 20th century, as different styles of architecture became more open in the 19th century, right? Moving a little bit away from the classical, neoclassical, you know, just kind of like general acceptance. Architecture sort of ran into the same problem that all sorts of aesthetics do, I think, whether that be, you know, concerns with music, art, architecture, whatever it is, which is, isn't what is beautiful just kind of subjective? You know, this song is good because I like it. People like Van Gogh's Starry Night because they like it. And lots of people like it, and therefore it's beautiful. There's nothing actually innate in that particular entity that makes it beautiful. Beauty is really this subjective thing. It's kind of BS, right? And this was actually the response that a lot of the modernists had. That basically, beauty is kind of BS. It's all about functionality. Obviously, as we've discussed, beauty still works its way in there. And because, again, coming back to that forms of life, you might even call this forms of societal life, beauty only makes sense within the terms of fitment. And what I mean by that term that I kind of, I could say fit, but I'm going to say fitment, I'm coining that, that's my new philosophical term, is that what makes something beautiful is also beautiful contextually speaking and historically, right? So let's talk about ancient Egypt and their architecture, right? I hope most of us can envision Egyptian architectural style, you know, with obviously with the pyramids, Sphinx, various temples, that kind of thing. Quite a unique ancient style. If you showed up in ancient Egypt and started building, you know, a standard two-story suburban home, everyone would be like, what's going on? Like, what is this? Like, this does not fit. it doesn't fit our forms of life, our societal life, our political life, our religious life. It's exactly, it's a rupture. It's out, it's complete. It's not even that it's like a wholly new and revolutionary. It's that it doesn't really make sense. Like, what are we, like, there's a developmental process, like anything in any kind of art, so too in architecture. And so things have to make sense. They have to be able, and they make sense because they can speak to us about our specific ways of life, who we are, what we should do. A suburban home in, you know, the second century BC, you know, dynastic Egypt would be effectively a giant question mark. Kind of like, and so that's where, again, it comes down to, there's this sort of reflexology going on in terms of our relationship to architecture and to aesthetics in general. And the idea that like beauty is not actually subjective. People have to be able to enjoy something, but that thing also has to be able to effectively manipulate a language of aesthetics that makes sense within their historical period and proceeding into that. You know, one thing that's often sometimes overlooked, I think, with aesthetics and especially with aesthetic entities is there are cases where things for a moment are considered beautiful or interesting, but then are roundly forgotten.
Mm.
Because for whatever reason, they do not pick up in the historical discourse in the way that some other entity might.
Yeah. Yeah. I can, with that case of the putting the suburban McMansion into ancient Egypt, it's possible to imagine a statue, maybe a marble statue, being brought in, because at least if the aesthetic object is well constructed, all the products are there. You only need that one statue in order to work up the entire experience. They might be missing a lot of historical context, the, you know, gestures and references and whatnot, but in something like a building, which it can't easily be divorced from the form of life which lives it, you know, there'd be a lot of appliances in it. There'd be a lot of empty rooms that are built in weird ways for them. But something like a statue is easy to pick up and kind of move to another gallery or country or wherever you want to bring it around to. So aesthetic objects can be moved around in a certain way. But that just, again, goes back to how, I guess, how wrong the modernists are to make that cleft between objectivity and subjectivity, between functionality and values, that the values that a building embodies, when you pick it up, the roots still are there. You really need to disentangle the roots if you want to get it out of there, if that image makes sense. But a building, it's the very fact that a building serves a function that gives it the aesthetic sensibilities that it does, because aesthetic sensibilities are going to be rooted in these contextual workings up of human values. And I wish I could be more specific about what human values mean, just because I'm coming from Dewey's perspective and he is a bit vague. But I think if we come back to this term of form of life, I think that might be a good supplement to it, that one lives a certain life. And life has lots of aspects, and we want buildings. If a building serves only one aspect, say like a financial building or something like that, if it's to be a beautiful building, and maybe this is why it's difficult for Dewey to envision a bank being beautiful, because you really could just have a bank with one aspect to it, but that single aspect is going to emerge out of a world that needs or that reflects lots of other different and important things like industry, work and whatnot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know what, as you say that, let's unpack a little bit of, you know, what these sorts of values are. I want to say that Alain, the bottom, I'll take a departure from him in a moment, but he very much aligns the beauty of buildings, the language of architecture, with effectively Aristotelian virtues in a way, that beautiful buildings are effectively virtuous buildings. They show off or display or articulate specific forms of life, specific cultural values or personal values that, you know, are, you know, in a kind of classic sense, good. You know, they're gentle, kind, open, like I said, democratic. You know, especially in the modern era now with design, you see a lot of buildings that are environmental. And this is one of the beautiful things we were talking about earlier with Frank Lloyd Wright and the, you know, short interviews in the 1950s. One of his big things, and which, you know, I think many people agree his buildings are, many of his homes that he created in particular are, you know, basically effectively works of art. But one of his big aspects was, you know, architecture, just like human beings, are not apart from the natural world. We are a part of that. We are a part of the natural world. And therefore, the things that we create and the way that we live should be attuned to that natural space. So for Frank Lloyd Wright, his designs were always very, took great care and understanding to the natural place and environment that they would be in. A hillside, what kind of foliage was around? Are they near water? How can we use that? How do we reflect that? How does the building point towards the stream that's nearby, or build into the hillside, or, you know, utilize the, you know, famous thinking about the waterfall house or whatever it's called, you know, utilizing the stream and small waterfall that runs through this property where we're building this home. How do we build that actually into the home and effectively incorporate that natural, natural entity into the actual space? And in fact, Lloyd Wright saw a lot of more modern architecture as the kind of opposition to that, as imposing a sort of synthetic, you know, both materially synthetic, but also in terms of kind of human organizational synthetic perspective, you know, with things like the skyscraper, which just kind of jut out of the world, are effectively have this sort of utilitarian bent and are just sort of there for our own purposes with little to no care for the world around it, and often involve the destruction of that to make happen. But I was going to say, Alain de Botton very similarly equates, you know, good architecture with the kind of virtuousness. But we can see how architecture and language of architecture speaks to us in all sorts of ways, even that's simplistic, probably for most people at home here, or most of our listeners at home. You know, one of the aspects of modern society, and especially when we talked earlier about classic suburban homes, is consumerism. You know, the value of consumerism. I don't literally mean, you know, the value of your dollars, but like the values that embody this sort of consumerist mindset that has very much been at play throughout the world, but especially in the Western world for a long time. If one looks around a classic suburban home, it is effectively a shell or space to enable a consumerist lifestyle, right? There is a lot, often, generally speaking, there's a lot of unused spaces that are filled with stuff. There's storage for stuff. There's garages for cars. Yeah, a car for multiple, oftentimes multiple cars. You know, there's cupboards and pantries, storage areas and closets, and, you know, all sorts of, you know, there's dens and living rooms and drawing rooms and offices that are unused that are all filled with things. And I know that sounds kind of like pedantic or whatever, but the point is that, like, one can easily look at, especially a classic suburban home, and see how this is a mold or a space for consumerism. This is a space for that kind of life, and it very clearly reflects that. And it's also in part because they are cheap. They are replicatable. They are effectively built like an assembly line, just like all the things that are that fill the homes.
Yeah,
of the people.
Their production reflects the production of the things that are consumed in them in a certain way.
Yes. De Botton very much notes that, you know, he kind of thinks that good architecture is virtuous architecture. It reflects a virtuosity of whatever sort of good things we're concerned, most concerned with, right? And that hopefully it's a space where we can engage and live in a lifestyle where we can do those things, or it might even inspire us. There's a way in which architecture is quite neutered. It doesn't really force anyone to live a certain way. It's more beckons or tries to inspire people. I would say, though, that good architecture in some ways is less about appealing to good virtues and is more about the how clearly it can speak on any particular virtue or perhaps even vice. If it speaks, you know, very loudly, there's a way in which I would say it's good architecture, but not morally good. And there's this moralistic component of the bottom that I kind of want to get away from. An example I'll use is something like a prison. The Panopticon was effectively like a kind of octagon-shaped building that had cells lining all the walls and a central tower from which, you know, the guards could effectively view every cell all the time. There's all sorts of philosophical, interesting metaphors that come out of the Panopticon. It's a very popular motif, but it's also a very interesting and appealing design in the sense that it very clearly speaks to authority, authoritarianism, a loss of freedom, servitude, punishment. It's a building that very clearly speaks these values. These might not be good values. It's not accurate to call them virtues. But the design itself, the architecture, is interesting because of how well it effectively speaks, how well it effectively talks to these nasty values.
I was going to comment on the Panopticon as being a kind of case study in showing your cards or not realizing how overboard you can go. It's a kind of symbol of hubris in a certain way. Utilitarianism was supposed to liberate people, but then you build the logical conclusion of discipline. In the form of total authoritarian suppression of prisoners. So it's an interesting case study in that.
Exactly. And another really interesting one that De Bottom brings up a little bit is, unsurprisingly, a Nazi architecture, Third Reich architecture. Nazis were very interested in aesthetics. It's part of their, you know, I think, interest today. And they constructed a lot of buildings that I would say are, like, frankly, have been quite inspiring to a lot of people. Albert Speer who is the Nazis' main architect, among other things, other wonderful activities that they all undertook together. Sarcasm, obviously, for our audience. There's many ways in which I think, actually, Albert Speer's architecture has been quite inspiring for later architects. It was quite impressive and weirdly beautiful in its own way. When you look at things like, again, we don't have photos, but when you look at, say, the 1936 Olympic Stadium, or you look at the Reich photos of the Reich Chancellery, which was destroyed, or you look at Paris World's Fair, like the pavilion the Nazis had, these were all commented on at the time as being very impressive, incredible structures. But, like, even now when we look back at them, they are so clearly authoritarian buildings. Like, they just have that look. Like, they have that look of just intensity, strength, imposition, and aggression. Yeah. and organization.
I wonder if Dewey's theory can't come in here to sort of save the phenomenon in a certain way, because these are people's first impressions in situ. You know, these are people seeing these unveiled at the height of this Reich. That certainly would be, I mean, I incline to want to see them sympathetically, because if we sort of do away with, well, it wasn't really dangerous, or it wasn't really that impressive, we kind of do away with what was truly dangerous about it, or what was, it was impressive to the people who engage with these things, and that's what was so powerful about it. And if we did away with that power, you lose a lot of the force of what was being fought at the time. You lose a lot of the explanatory force of, well, why did people do these things? But I bring in Dewey's theory here to say, well, there's a certain kind of experience that hasn't been worked out to its full conclusion yet. These buildings might seem impressive, but under certain conditions, they fall, or because they need a an authoritarian structure to hold them up. They need authoritarian values. They embody that. And that sort of state flashes like a fire in a certain way, and it eventually went out.
The beauty is never isolated. It's always contextual, and that context might change over time and how we reflect upon them, or at the period of their creation, whatever it might be. Again, we go back to the suburban home in second millennia BC Egypt would just be weird. It would just be like concerning. Beautiful buildings, impressive buildings, powerful buildings, whether that be for good or ill, are powerful because they are able to adequately speak within their historical context and then continue on that conversation afterwards in certain sort of ways, even if that conversation kind of changes as to what they are, right? How we reflect upon, let's say, Nazi structures now. They might still be impressive in different ways, but also to elucidating certain kinds of concern, tragedy, horror, whatever it might be. But it's the fact that they're able to still do that, right? That they don't just look like something, some boring, whatever, a warehouse, whatever it might be. It's the fact that they're able to talk. That is what really elucidates, you know, good, or we might call powerful or impactful architecture.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
I think that's all the time we have for today. I really enjoyed our conversation. I hope all you did as well.
Please email us at hello@philosophyshow.ca.
When I sent the Megaras, who had a squelch, give it all away. What does it mean to bear witness? The act of witnessing is also the act of universal acceptance. Giving is intertwined with wealth and abundance, depending on the reciprocal relationship one has with land and community. It is this ideology that has helped indigenous nations maintain sustenance for centuries. Following the Megaras, performance at SFE Gallery in fall 2022, who had a squelch, give it all away. Guest participants were invited to recount the event in, as Megaras describes, a collective remembering, a truth about an experience. Listen as participants Tanya Lucan Linklater, Alisa Johnny Hawkins, and Mikhail DeAngeli share their witness encounters together in a conversation airing December 12th and 19th on Speaker from 10 to 11 a.m.
This is Free Voices at CJSF 90.1 FM talking to you about
Eagle Nation Universal Production Society. We are 10 board of directors, and we are rejoicing for world history. Our show is based on true stories, musical and storytelling and role playing, silent crimes broken, very interesting series of show.
And a lot of in-depth oral tradition. We play every Thursday from 3 to 4. Come and join us.